Our guest today, John Rennie, he reminds me of the Ben Franklin quote, that if you want to get something done, give it to someone who's busy. And I'll tell you, John Rennie, through his life and his career, has been one busy guy and has gotten a lot done. He started out in the military. He was a U.S. Navy nuclear sub officer who made, catch this, 7 deployments during the Cold War. He comes out, and over a number of years, he leads 8 manufacturing businesses across 3 global companies. And currently, John is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Peak Demand Inc., which is a premier manufacturer of critical components for electrical utilities. And in his spare time, he's written 3 books on leadership and hosts a podcast called Deep Leadership, play on words, being in the sub, about his experience and what he's learned about leadership. Leadership is his passion. And oh, by the way, he's currently in a doctorate program on leadership. Let me stop talking. Let's get to John. Come on in, grab a snack. Welcome.
I have to start by laughing because we've been getting ready to start for quite a while. Anyhow, good morning, Bob. Good morning, listeners. Grab a snack. Come on in. I feel like I have a friend here as a guest because I've spoken to him before, John Rennie, who we share some common blood, actually, or in from being from New England. And he has a very interesting background, which Bob will tell you about. But I know that we essentially, when we spoke, threw away any formal questions and just had a conversation. So I'm looking forward to a conversation with John Rennie, who has had an interesting continuum of leadership that he can talk about. And our goal is that you get to say what you want to say about leadership. With that, I'll turn it to Bob.
Yeah, I'm good if I ask. Well, welcome, John. And Joyce, you know, you did a great job getting us kind of grounded. You don't know this, John, but I actually lived in Exeter, New Hampshire for 5 years. So when I saw Manchester, I'm like, okay. And you live in North Carolina now, and I'm here in North Carolina. So,
oh, yeah. Okay, great.
You and Joyce have your connection, and you and I have a connection. So,
and there are Hannaford stores everywhere.
Yes, there are. So let's start out. The name of your company is Deep Leadership. And in reading some about you, there's a little bit of a play on both of those words. Why don't you tell us what that is in terms of the title of your company?
Yeah. So, I mean, I started writing about leadership issues about 10 years ago. One of the things is I reflected on sort of my leadership journey, and I started thinking about, like, why were my businesses performing better than my peers and my competitors? And it was about 10 years ago when I realized, like, oh, shoot, a lot of the ideas that I learned in the Navy as a submarine officer, which is what I did right out of college, was my first job, my first leadership job. A lot of the principles I learned under the ocean applied really well to running teams on land. And so my teams were always very successful. My factories, my companies that I ran were very successful. And so about 10 years ago, I started writing about why, you know, what are some of those elements to leadership, the lessons I learned under the ocean. And I brought it into, you know, books and a podcast. And Deep Leadership seemed to resonate for 2 reasons. One is, I'm a former submariner. We spent a lot of time under the ocean, right? So part of it, but also the idea of like deep work, deep thinking, deep leadership. Leadership is a subject that it's like chess. You can learn it maybe in a week or two, but it takes a lifetime to master. And so that's what I've learned over the years is that it is a deep well, and there's always something to learn. And I'm still learning 30 plus years into it, how to become a better leader.
That's great. So, you know, what I find interesting in learning a little bit about your background is you kind of backed into this career, if I understand it right. You wanted to go to college coming from a black collar family. You needed to get a scholarship. So you kind of backed your way into, well, the Navy has scholarships. So I love that story just because of the happenstance and you found a passion. But here we are now. You've been, 20 years doing this leadership gig. Why that? Why run manufacturing facilities. What about you took you in that direction?
Well, it's interesting because I had a dream or desire as a child to go into the Navy. I had one grandfather who was in the Navy in World War II, another grandfather in the Army. And for me, I was fascinated by the stories of submariners in World War II. And I said, and I set my sights on being on a submarine, even as young as in junior high school. That's what I wanted to do. And so that was like my life's desire. And I ended up fulfilling my life dream and becoming a submarine officer. And that is rare. Most people like want to be a firefighter, a policeman, or an astronaut. That stuff fades, right? And you end up becoming an accountant, right? Or a lawyer or whatever. But for me, it never faded. And so I ended up fulfilling my life's dream and became a naval officer. The problem came is when I got out of the Navy. I decided to leave the Navy because I saw, let's just say, a lot of families don't make it through a career in the Navy because we spend a lot of time at sea. And I kind of liked my wife, and I thought, well, let's, like, maybe we'll stay together. And we did, and we have. So we're 31 years now together. But I didn't want to end up like most career Navy guys. So I decided to get out and join corporate. And I would tell you this is that when you're in the military, you sort of have like a big picture, a vision. You have a mission. And for me, when I left the military, I lost that mission and I didn't know what I was going to do. I really struggled. And a lot of military veterans struggle when they get out of the military. And it took me about 7 years before I really found my calling again, when I found my true north. And it came about when I was actually my second manufacturing plant I was in charge of. It was a struggling manufacturing plant. They put me in charge of it. And it was one of the situations where it was going to get shut down if we didn't fix it. And I realized about maybe 6 months into that job, into my second manufacturing plant, that this is exactly where I want to be. I want to be helping these people turn this business around and make it successful to save their jobs. And that's when it became my new true north, was turning around struggling manufacturing businesses. And that's what I've been doing most of my career, up until 8 years ago when I left corporate and started my own business. But yeah, I found my true north again, but it took a long time to find it again. And that was, and that's really important, I think, as leaders or just as people, is that what is it that you've been put on earth to do? And figure that out. That's really important.
Yeah, you know, I was going to ask. Say, go ahead, Joyce.
You say, I stumbled into this or I stumbled into that, or how did, you know, I wanted to be a submarine officer. What choices did you make that kept you on that road where you could have been knocked off? There's something you did, both in living your first dream and in finding your second. What did you do that put you where you wanted to be?
Well, it's interesting because it's sort of a binary choice. When I came out of the military, I had two job offers. One was go into engineering for products for electric utilities, which I had an engineering degree, which made sense. And the other one was going into pharmaceutical sales. They were recruiting a lot of naval officers into pharmaceutical sales. So that was the first binary choice I made. I didn't know anything about pharmaceutical sales. So I was like, well, I know a little bit about engineering. So I made that choice, is to go in that route. And when I got there, one of the things I recognize is, like, there was a huge gap between the office people and the people on the shop floor. Like, the office people had free coffee, air conditioning, nice, clean, neat, orderly workplaces. And then I go out on the shop floor, and this was in Florida at the time. It was non-air conditioned. It was dirty. It was dusty. It was an us and them attitude. And I remembered my time in the military was not us and them. We were all in it together. In fact, the title of my second book is All in the Same Boat. We were all in it together. And what I noticed in corporate, or at least in my time, my initial first job, was that there is this us and them, the haves and the have nots. And I said, this is not the way you should run a business. And so I set upon starting to think about, like, how could I bring the ideas I had in the military into business? And through different roles and responsibilities, I became the quality manager. Eventually, I was started out as a design engineer. I was asked to be the quality manager. That was my first foray into corporate management. Then I became the engineering manager for the division. And then a manufacturing plant opened up, and they asked me to be the leader of that manufacturing plant. So it was sort of a series of, I don't know, just trial and error, but I had a passion for getting rid of this us and them that I saw in the corporate environment.
Yeah, that explains. I was going to ask you about your the byline of your business, life, passion, and business. And you did a pretty good job without being asked the question, sizing that up. Let's talk a little bit about your leadership. So we got your point of view about creating this one team, all in the same boat. What about your leadership? What would you say are the main characteristics or strengths that you bring to the game?
So, it used to be, and it's interesting because now I'm actually working on a doctorate in leadership right now. And so when you get into the academic side of leadership, there's all these leadership theories that, by the way, I never heard of in throughout my life, right? No one
Yeah.
ever told me that there was, like 14 different specific theories on leadership. And so, because I often got asked the question when I started writing about leadership is, what is your leadership style? And I would always default to servant leadership because that's the one I knew, because that's the one that sort of broke into mainstream press, right? But when I started doing a lot more research and study into leadership, I found a transformational leadership style, and I started reading about that and understanding it, and I went, oh, I'm not a servant leader at all. I'm definitely a transformational leader. I believe in the people and the mission. When part of the challenge with servant leadership, it's all about people, putting people first in the hopes that the business results will get better. And in most cases, there's correlation between the two. However, I've always believed in transforming the people in pursuit of transforming the business. And so that's where I would say my leadership style has always fit in with. My job has always been transforming people to transform a business that's struggling. So yeah, that's where more my leadership style has fallen into.
And that I get a sense of relief when I hear you say that because I realize I'm balking at the articles on empathy and kindness. And in fact, I wrote a model on fully human leadership. But the emphasis, I believe in a mission that creates the container for the growth, which is a lot like a submarine.
Yeah.
So how do you create? I mean, a submarine gives you, we're all in it together. We may not like each other or anything, but we are in it. So how do you create that we are in it with people working at home and da 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 and also the value of satisfying work
So this
is
is
not
really,
emphasized enough.
yeah. This is so powerful because you're hitting it right where it counts. So my first manufacturing plant, I was 34 years old, and this is the problem I noticed, which was there was a definitely an us and them attitude at this plant. It was a different plant that I was asked to lead. It was an us and them attitude. So the office people did office things, the people on the shop floor did shop things, and no one really knew what they were doing together, first of all. And the other thing is when I first started walking around the shop and asking people what they did, they would say, I plate this part. I grind this part. I weld this part. And I would say, well, what does this part do? And they would say, I don't know. And so connecting, so part, you just mentioned something. Worthwhile work is such an essential part of what we do. What we all want as humans, we want to know that we're doing something valuable. And so, the first thing that I did was to try to break down the barriers. And what I did was I created something eventually was called Fridays on the Floor. And it started out with just me. So the first Friday of every month, I would spend the first 4 hours of every day working in a different area of the shop. Literally just go out with my jeans on, safety glasses, safety shoes, and I would just do, like, the show Undercover Boss, where the guy shows up and he works with the people. It was a really popular show. I was doing this long before I even Undercover Boss ever came out, which was the boss goes out the shop floor and works with the employees. And what it was I connected with the individuals. They got to know me very well. I got to know them very well. And I got to know what was really happening in the shop floor. The tooling that was broken that needed to be repaired, the instructions that were terrible, the quality problems that were being hidden that really no one knew about it. I started seeing the world through the lens of my employees versus the lens of someone sitting in a corner office. I was so excited. I would call my staff, the leadership team, every I'd say, guys, I learned this and this and this. And they would all look at me and go, okay. And finally, I realized they weren't sharing the same experiences I was having. So I pushed this down to where all managers, every Friday, first Friday of every month, worked 4 hours on the line in a different place every month. And after that,
I can just see the employees at first going, oh no, here they come.
Exactly. There comes
John's
the quality
a good guy.
Problems.
My boss is a jerk.
But what was neat about it, then I would have like, I would bring in pizza and we would just get together for lunch and we write down everything we learned through those experiences. And that became sort of our action list of things that we worked on. And so a couple of things happened there. One is the employees saw us, they met us, they learned, they figured out who we were and what we did, right? And we learned who they were and what they did. And we started addressing their problems and fixing things and taking away the barriers to them being successful. And they're like, management is finally listening. And it's like we were listening because we were experiencing things together. Now, so that helped us bring the two groups together. So, you know, kind of building that bond. The second thing we did was recognizing that that there was no connection between what they did and the products that we built and what they did in the world. And so we recognized we needed to fix that. And so we started communicating a different message, which was you don't plate parts, you don't machine parts, you don't weld parts. You are helping keep the lights on. The work that you're doing is powering hospitals, it's powering restaurants, it's powering where your kids go to school. You're helping keep the lights on. And it was almost like when we started communicating that message, it was almost like a sense of pride. You could almost see like everybody just a little more pride, you know, in their work. They would go home and tell their families that, you know, what did I do today? Well, and I would tell them where their product was going to. Oh, you guys, all these breakers, circuit breakers are going to, they're building a brand new airport in Saudi Arabia. And you guys are keeping the lights on at that airport. They're like, wow, that's really cool. And they would tell their family about it, right? They were suddenly now doing the same job. But now we've connected it to the worthwhile work, the good things they were doing in the world, which they never saw before. And that helped bring pride and it helped bring us together as an organization.
You know, I'm curious.
And it's so much fun. Go ahead. Yeah. I'll remember.
No, what I love about our conversation so far, you talk about going to school and getting your doctorate in leadership. You're teaching the class right now today. You've got it. So here's my question. This is a little bit of the cynic in me. So you've worked with these leadership teams and you've come in to shift the culture to create one team. Did you get any resistance or it's like, I don't want to give up my parking spot? Did you get any pushback?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because I think, and it took a while for managers to understand what I was trying to do. Because I give you an example. This one plant that I ran here in North Carolina, the first thing I did was I didn't even walk in the. Well, I walked in the door. I was greeted by the HR manager, and I said, "Who's the maintenance manager?" And they told me who it was. I said, "Can you have him come out and meet me in the parking lot?" And he came out there and he said, "Hi, I'm John Reddy. Nice to meet you. I'm the new plant manager." I said, "Do you guys have any paint back there?" And they're like, "Yeah." I said, "Can you do me a favor and paint over?" They had the concrete barriers and they had everybody's title in the front part of the parking lot. I said, mm-hmm. "Can you paint those over?" Even before I even walked in the building, I was painting over the assigned parking spots. And so I do, usually I'll do something when I first take over a business to get people talking. And so I use the fact that every eye is on you in those first early days to do something one thing I learned about in the military is the rumor mill is the most effective communication. So I use that so instead of putting out a message, here's what I stand for, I just do something right. Like paint over the parking spots and like now everyone knows where I stand. And so, yeah, I think some managers were like, "Hey, that's my perk. Hey, I earned it." And like, you don't get a perk. I mean, we're in it together. You have a mission. You might be the supply chain manager. You have a mission, but you're no better than anyone else in this business. And I'm no better than anyone else in this business.
I'm thinking of so many things. Bob and I actually ran how many vision meetings?
Oh my gosh.
And
oh, easily.
A new CEO was introducing himself to the company. He was well known, but we did guided imagery with 350 people 10 times so that they created that direction in the moment, viscerally, everything from having to create a wordless expression of what they wanted their work and the outcome to look like. So I'm a big believer in big, large system meetings. It takes skill. It takes good communication things. Remember when we had airplane signals coming into a meeting? The fundamental thing that you talk about all the time is learn, 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 learn. You say it all the time, you act it all the time. So you certainly create the value of learning. And what was my point? When do you, okay, so on the submarine, safety and survival and everything keep you together. And back to the same question, how do you get that same intensity of cooperation or brotherhood or sisterhood without that? Is it the mission that makes the container?
I think it does. One of the things that's interesting is, so we had a common enemy on a submarine, right? Number one enemy, this is during the Cold War, was the Soviet Union. Number two enemy was the ocean. The ocean wanted to crush us like a tin can, sending us to the bottom of the ocean, right? So we had two enemies that we faced. So one of the things I do is I actually put a face on the enemy. So I will let, because that's how you kind of build a team, is that you all point to a shared enemy. The enemy, one of the things I always say is the enemy is not inside the four walls. The enemy is outside the four walls. It is not, purchasing's not your problem. Sales are not your problem. Marketing's not your problem. Your problem is the competition. My problem is the competition. So I was steering everybody towards, hating. That's not a good word, but knowing who the enemy was, pointing out the enemy. So I would actually come into the meetings, and I would actually have a picture of the CEO of our biggest competitor. And I can't remember his name now, but I used to always say, "See this guy? This is Joe. Joe lives a comfortable life. You know why he lives a comfortable life? Because he's kicking our butts and he's getting big paychecks. And I don't want Joe to get any more paychecks. What do you guys think?" And so it was sort of steering everybody towards like a common enemy. And it was more comical. It wasn't like we're going to kill this guy. It was more like it was used as a way to say, let's point our anger towards. Let's put our passion towards beating the competition versus beating up on each other.
Bob, remember when Walmart was the enemy?
Oh yeah. Oh, and
And it was
it
very
galvanized
exciting and
us.
exhilarating.
Yeah.
Yeah,
It's it's
and so I love
it,
that.
I have a question moment. There's an interesting backstory. For the longest time, the FTC, the government, didn't recognize Walmart as a grocer until they became the largest grocer in the world. So for years, we weren't looking at them. And as soon as we put a face, that little smiley sun face, it kind of galvanized our strategy about where we needed to go. So I love your story. So this is a show not only about wins, but also about hacks, where you perhaps didn't get it exactly right. And you've talked about learning, learning, learning. Most learning comes from taking a risk and making a mistake. Why don't you share one of your hacks with us and what you learned from it?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. There's one expression I've always heard that it says, you get, part of leadership is getting everybody rowing in the same direction, but also watching out for the guy drilling a hole in the bottom of your boat. And that's the one I probably have failed the most in, is because I guess I get everybody sort of going, and I got all in the same boat, but there's always a 1% or a 2% that might be working to go against you. And I've had some circumstances where I've had some employees working against me, which ended up, in one case, I ended up losing my job over it because I had somebody that was intent on getting me out of my position because they didn't like the amount of change we were bringing. And so I think, and it's because I'm an optimistic person, and I have tremendous respect for everyone, and you don't have to earn it in my book. I have respect for you on day one, and you lose that respect through your actions, but I have respect for you. And so there are certain people that I gave undue respect to that were working against me, and I wasn't sensitive enough to see where people were working against me. And that's the thing, is because I don't believe in politics and I don't play politics. Our job, we have a mission. I'm going to tell you what the mission is, and I'm going to help you be effective in getting that mission done. There are people that are motivated towards not just towards the mission and group success. They're after their own individual careers. And I've learned that over the years, that some people are motivated based on selfish means. And so I've learned that over the years, that you've got to kind of watch out for those people that are vested in just themselves only.
So, John, I can guarantee
have we learned
you,
that yet, Bob?
That's exactly what I was going to say. I'm grimacing as I listen to you because that's a mistake I've made again and again, and I'm sure our listeners have. And, you know, interesting. Joyce, I kind of anticipate when you have a question, so I can feel one coming.
I don't.
So
I can generate one if you really want me to.
Well, I'm going to ask one, and then you can ask a thoughtful, provocative question. John, we talked early on about the challenges of former military transitioning into civilian life, and you shared a little bit about your own story. That, I mean, 7 years just rolled off your tongue like, yeah, it was 7 years. 7 years is a long time.
Kind of biblical.
So when you're working with clients or former military now, what are the lessons that you've learned that you try to share or share with them?
So one of the big things that you find is that when you're in the military, your life is pretty well structured, right? There is a plan for you. Like when I first showed up to the submarine, there was a plan for me to get qualified, right? So it takes about a year long process to learn every one of the ship systems, to sand all the watches, to become fully qualified. And then once you're fully qualified and you stand watches, then there's the next level, the next level, the next level. So your whole life is well, you don't have to look for what to do next because it's there, and you're around people who are a little further along the process than you. You can talk to them, right? So you come into the civilian world, and this is the biggest problem with military people, is we come into the civilian world, and like for my example, I was put in a cubicle. I had to wait, I don't know, 3 to 4 weeks before I got a computer. I had a stapler, and I had a light above my head that was blinking because it was broken or something. I was sitting in an empty cubicle with a stapler and a blinking light, and I'm like, well, now what? Like, I didn't know. Like, no, there was no qual card. There was no process for me. There was no onboarding process, at least back for me. And I think most companies are better at that now, but no onboarding process. And then my boss was fired about 2 months after he hired me. So a new guy was brought in. I had no idea why I was here. So I said to myself, well, what did I do in the military? Well, I got qualified. Well, what did that mean? Well, I meant I walked around the ship and I met with the most experienced people, and I asked them what they did, and I learned from them. And so I went ahead and created my own qualification program. And I remember going talking to the engineers. I said, listen, I don't know what all I'm supposed to be doing here, but if you ever go out on the shop floor, if you're working on a project, please call me, and I just want to sit by you. Show me what you're doing. I want to learn it. And so I started learning from everybody in the business. So I'd spend time with purchasing. I'd spend time with quality. I'd spend time with the sales guys. What do you do? Why do you do it? And I was just curious, and I was learning because I really had no program. They didn't train me. There was nothing. And so what I found is through that process is that there was all these needs. The company had needs, and I would volunteer for everything. So that we need an internal auditor. I go, I don't know what that is. I'll do it. We need someone to run this. We got an employee event. I'm like, I'll do it. I don't know what that is, but I'll do it. So I kept volunteering for things. And so it didn't take me long before I was adding value, and I started learning the business, and people saw me as, hey, this is a guy that just does whatever it takes. He cares about the business. He cares about the people. He wants to get to know us. So I built relationships all over the business, and I built skills. I stacked all these different skill sets that I. So one of the areas I became really good at nuclear QA, quality assurance for nuclear power plants. And the way I developed my expertise is I actually read the government standard on the quality programs for, and I read it cover to cover. And so when it came to the need, they needed somebody to be an internal quality auditor for nuclear programs. Like, well, John knows this stuff. And so I got that. And then when a quality manager job opened up, like, well, John could do it. So it was suddenly like it was the easiest decision to make is to put me into these more senior positions because I had, you know, I'd learned the stuff. And so I think there's something to be said about, you know, one is taking your career ownership. You have to own your own career. No one's going to help you once you get out of the military. You got to take ownership, and you want to become valuable. How do you become qualified in the civilian world. I don't know, it's going to be different for every business, but I bet if you talk to a lot of experienced people in your business, you can figure it out. You know, how do you become good at what you do? And I think there's a part of it, is it Mark Cuban that says you need to outwork and outlearn your peers? Mm-hmm. And that was truth to me. So I was like, I'm going to outwork and I'm going to outlearn everybody. So I had a passion of learning and trying to grow. So,
well, you've got a kindred spirit in Joyce, because what we would refer to what you did is you would scrounge around.
Yeah.
If you didn't know something, you'd knock on someone's door and say, hey, do you mind telling me how this works? Joyce is a master at that, and it sounds as if you are as well.
Yeah, I had to. I mean, like I said, when your boss gets fired 2 months, like I was like an orphan. What do I do? Oh, you want to see something funny? This is the same stapler that I had 1990.
I love it.
1994. Oh, my gosh. No, you can't quite see it. 1994, when I first got hired outside of the military. Yay. That's the stapler. It was in my office. I've had it in my desk drawer my whole career. And that's the only thing I was given, was a stapler.
Wow. Look at the color of that stapler.
Isn't that wild? That's when they made real products.
It's a turquoise stapler made out of like solid steel.
It weighs like a pound.
But it still works, right?
It still works. It's still in my drawer.
We've got a little bit more time, Joyce. You've got something on your mind.
I'm thinking about so many things, because I certainly did follow your pattern. I usually got an idea because I did go around and infiltrate. And I went where I wasn't wanted, and in fact got made fun of, because I always took red licorice to meetings. What do we say, because I see many women, like there's a second wave of women in leadership now that seems to have had a different experience from the first wave of feminism, which is me, which is you own it, you do it, you figure it out. You add value, you build relationships with people that don't like you or don't want you or don't understand you, and you keep trying to serve, and you show that you're a person. And that humor played a big role in my building of relationships. But the real thing was I would capture an idea that I knew would work. And that's what gave me impetus to take that to somebody and say, I have an idea. Like we created learning training groups because my budget was cut. So I turned store managers in a district into a self-taught learning group, gave them a structure for it. It was great. How rare is that kind of initiative? Because I'm saying, how do we grow? And I was thinking of women leaders in particular right now, the taking that first step, take it again. Don't wait for anything, make something good happen. And I see a lot of, people are worn out right now too, but waiting for someone else to fix it. Yeah. See more of that now than in the past.
Yeah, I see that.
I have no idea what I'm asking. I guess I'm saying, do you see any, am I making any sense?
I think you're right. I think that I do often talk to a lot of young people, and I do remind them, because I think they think that someone's going to look out for them. Someone's going to look out for their career. Yeah, I think we can end up getting mentors and people senior to us in a company that may watch out for us and look out for us, help us develop our career. But I think the main message I tell young people today is that you have to manage your own career, and you have to take initiative. And the point of the matter is, you know, is that company managers are lazy, right? And so, like for me, when they saw me taking initiative, they're like, oh, there's a guy that can do it. So here's the deal. We put more of our workload on the people that are getting things done. And so if you're someone that is proved to be capable, and it doesn't matter, you know, male, female, or whatever, if you're able to deliver and you're delivering value all the time, you're going to get more opportunities to do that on a larger scale. I really do believe that now more than ever. And so I think there's more opportunities for people who are self-starters and are able to get things done. I obviously got to play within the confines of the politics and the rules of an organization too, because I found at least one of my corporate jobs was there was a really strong culture against self-starters. So you got to be in the right place. So, yeah. Yeah, I found out right away that I was running an R&D organization for a large company. And I was like, well, you know, we were developing a product and someone's like, well, we don't really know what the customers are saying about this product. And, you know, we were talking about this one feature. And I said, well, let's go talk to them. So I just went out, I started visiting customers. And then I found out that in the history of this company, no engineering manager had ever gone to visit a customer. Like, you're not allowed to do that. The salesman talked to the customer, you do engineering work in the back room. And but I'm like, okay, no, that's not how we do things. I'm going to be a self-starter. But yeah, you're going to run into that sometimes where you might ruffle some feathers, but do it for the right reasons and be a self-starter.
Well, yeah, and I'm thinking about that role of courage, but I'm also thinking of that role of acting in the moment. Based on what you just said, I was kind of guiding a board, the European board, through Food Lion store, and they were talking a lot about customer, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know what? We're in a store with customers. Why don't we each of us go talk to three customers, and then when we come back, we can see what we found out. Ironically, somebody, like, I don't know if it was Walmart or whoever, was videoing, and so one of our board members got interviewed for a Walmart thing. But
oh, that's funny.
They found out all kinds of things. Pierre Olivier, the CEO, needed drops for his eyes. He kept asking people where they were. Nobody knew. Nobody took him. Nobody cared. So I love the immediacy of your approach.
Yeah, go. I think it's, you know, I've studied lean manufacturing. And so, you know, Gemba is where, you know, where the value is added, you know, and I think that's, I think we need to go where the value is added. And so when it comes to customer opinions, talk to a customer. When it comes to the employees, go where they work, you know, go where the majority of your people are. Some people say, well, where's Gemba? I always say you should walk around Gemba. That's where the value is at. Well, where's Gemba in my business? Like, well, usually it's where most of your employees are, right? If it's a call center, that's probably the call center room, or, you know, or if it's a factory, it's in the factory. If it's a firehouse, it's going to be down, you know, where everybody's doing maintenance on their fire equipment. You want to go where your employees are and listen to the employees and spend time with them. And you got to be present.
The smoking place that Rick.
Yeah, that's where you're going
to
find it.
That a couple times. Yeah, go down in this. So I want to shift. I want to ask you, John. Looking to the future, you said you're a transformational leader. As you look at the world, as you look at those things that you see on the horizon, where's your passion taking you looking forward? What's next for you?
So. So the podcast that I run, Deep Leadership, is the mission is to build a world with better bosses. And so one of the things I really love doing is talking to students. So I talk to a lot of graduate students. I come in for leadership sessions with graduate and undergraduate students. I do talk to some high school students as well, but mostly graduate students. And so finishing up my doctorate right now in leadership. And I will be teaching on a part-time basis, doing some university teaching. So, and then, I think, I still run my manufacturing business that I started 8 years ago. It's called Peak Demand. And so I'm running, my full-time job is running my manufacturing business. But as I tell people, I put on my Superman cape at night and I become a leadership guy at night. So that's when I do my podcast and prepare for various things. But no, I think more teaching, more directing. I do mentor a number of different, like I'm mentoring a CEO right now, a young CEO, and helping him make a transition to that CEO role. And just helping leaders any way I can. So either through college instruction, through lectures, through mentoring, and running the podcast and the books that I write. So just helping leaders.
In order to build
a world with better bosses. That's my objective. That's my passion. Because you have a better bosses, you're gonna have a better world. you're gonna have better employees. My biggest thing is engagement. You know, the 70% disengagement number that has existed for 20 plus years. I think it's time for us to do something about it. You know, I mean, it's
people say it's the pandemic. We've been jabbering about all this stuff forever. That's why I love to see, and what I'm poking at is where's the kernel your energy comes from? And I keep thinking when you went into the first plant about these people are going to lose their jobs. Let's get it going and save. So I'm wondering, I'm just curious about where your fundamental kernel is.
I think it's the
I'm
that I
wondering
grew
where
up.
mine is too, but I'm
Yeah, I think it's because I grew up a blue collar guy. I grew up in a blue collar family, the first to go to college, and I have a deep passion for blue collar workers. I feel like they're treated like crap, and they're the first people that get outsourced. They get let go, and I don't think that a lot of leaders are in it for the team. They're in it for themselves. Their bonus checks, their company car, their corner office. And I say, screw that. That's not what you become a leader to make a difference, not to make money. Yeah, you might make money, but you do it to make a difference. And so, yeah, I'm in it to make sure that my teams have long careers in my company if they choose to stay with me. That's why I do it.
now I that got it, baby. I'm
Yeah,
a blue
I
collar.
am com
I'm a
as
blue
Joyce
collar
said, and
daughter.
I would say I am complete. Is there anything that you'd like to share before we sign off?
No, I mean, I appreciate your time together. I think the one thing I tell people that it's really gets forgotten sometimes is that, and I'll give you this quick analogy: a ship without a crew is just a hunk of steel sitting in the water, right? It's useless. Okay. Our businesses, our plans, everything we want to do are useless without people. So leadership is a people business. It's all about people. It is not about you. It's about people. And I think once we sort of make that transition and learn and appreciate that it's people that make bring our plans to life, then we change who we are as leaders. It's all about people.
So I'm going to urge our listeners to Google John Rennie, Renie, to check out more about him, listen to his podcast, and I think he'd actually even potentially be willing to consult with you.
Absolutely. Anything I can do to help.
Great. John, thank you very much. Appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Our hope is that you got as much out of today's conversation and enjoyed it as much as Joyce and I did. Thank you, John, for being a guest on the show and sharing with us some of the key elements of what makes you a good leader that we can learn from. So, if you are interested in being a guest on the show, or if you know someone who you think would be a good guest on the show, reach out to Joyce and I at bobandjoyce.com. We'd love to hear from you, and until the next time, be well and be safe.